This is Word of Mouth from NHPR, and I'm Virginia Prescott with another episode of Civics 101, the podcast refresher course on some basics that you may have forgotten or slept through during school. We've invited you to submit your questions about how our democracy works, which is how today's question came to us.
My name is John, and I'm a history teacher in Saco, Maine. Can you help me explain the National Security Council to my students? Who serves on it? How do they get on it? For how long? What do they do? And why is Steve Bannon's appointment such a big deal?
So, Stephen, do you think you can help John?
I hope so.
Well, before we get to your answer, please tell us who you are.
My name is Steve Sestanovich. I teach American foreign policy at Columbia University, and I'm a fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. And I guess you have firsthand knowledge of the National Security Council.
I worked in the NSC staff in the Reagan administration. And in the Clinton administration, I worked at the State Department, but dealt with the NSC staff all the time.
Well, so now we've got you here. Let's start with the basics. Yeah. When was the National Security Council created?
Short answer is in 1947. In the wake of World War II, Americans understood that they had to modernize the process and the institutions by which they made foreign policy and national security policy. And there were a number of changes made. The CIA was created. There was a Secretary of Defense position created that replaced the old division between Secretary of War and Secretary of the Navy. And there was a council created for the president, for his top advisors, Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense, to formalize the process of bringing their recommendations to him and helping him to select among them. I should add one other thing to this picture, though. In 1947, the position of National Security Advisor was not as big a job as we now envision it. It was a kind of staff coordinator position. The position of National Security Advisor was really in its modern form only created in the late 60s, early 70s. And the National Security Council staff itself has gotten bigger decade by decade.
So it has evolved. The National Security Council and the attendant staff has evolved over the years. What is the actual purpose of the NSC now?
Well, it's the body that meets with the president to decide on major foreign policy, defense policy decisions. And he can have other people in there besides the ones who were statutorily members of the NSC. Representatives from other agencies participate. They're generally supposed to create a set of options for the president based on the positions taken by different agencies, give him an orderly set of choices to make, and then help him implement them.
So since it's evolved, is there any kind of rule or statute guiding who sits on the NSC?
Well, the National Security Act of 1947 does set out the members, but they can be changed at the discretion of the president. I don't think there's ever been a time when this Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense weren't on. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs and the head of the CIA are, I believe, according to the statute, advisors rather than full members. But when you get around the table, that doesn't really matter all that much. You know, as Lincoln said, the president's cabinet doesn't vote. They tell the president what their views are, and then he decides. So it doesn't, you know, when you're sitting around the table, and you'll notice this often when you see pictures of the president with his advisors in the Situation Room, sometimes the order of seating is by prearrangement, but there can be a lot of people in the room. The president can decide, for example, he wants to have the Secretary of the Treasury there, or he wants to have the Attorney General there. But a lot of this is styled for the president's preferences and according to the kind of decision that they're going to make. For example, when the Bush administration was working on its decision to get into the war in Iraq, there wasn't actually a full dress NSC meeting to discuss this question. And a lot of people have made the criticism that it was easier to kind of make a decision that wasn't fully thought through because there wasn't a full dress process with an options paper, contrasting views. The administration, in a way, kind of worked on the decision, but never in as formalized a way as critics have subsequently said they should have done, and even as some people at the time felt they should do.
Okay, so there was considerable shock when it was revealed that the White House chief strategist Steve Bannon would be appointed to the Principals Committee of the National Security Council, and that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and director of national intelligence would be removed from the Principals Committee. What is the Principals Committee?
The Principals Committee is the meeting of all of the members of the NSC without the president. And that can be preparatory to a full meeting with the president, or it can be an occasion in which the PC deliberates and then sends its recommendations to the president, and he decides separately. That is a convention that has developed over the past couple of decades. But the core of it is it's not an NSC meeting unless the president is there. The Principals Committee meeting, though, does define the status of some of the participants. And Bannon is now a full member of the Principals Committee meeting. So in that respect, he is on a par with the Secretary of Defense and the Secretary of State. It's not completely unprecedented for the president to have other advisors. There are cases going back to Presidents Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, where the presidents would bring in other people. For example, in the meetings that led up to the decisions in the Cuban Missile Crisis, President Kennedy brought in Ted Sorensen, his speechwriter, as a full participant in the discussions. And that was because he wanted to have his eyes and ears there. He wanted to have his speechwriter hearing what was discussed. And other presidents have brought in their chief of staff or have brought in other domestic advisors so that they can understand better what the decisions are that are at stake and how to present them more appropriately to the Congress, to the public, and so forth. In that respect, a president who wants to make sure that there's a kind of seamless continuity between foreign and domestic politics is doing something smart. The uproar created by the appointment of Steve Bannon has a lot to do with who Steve Bannon is and the views that he is thought to represent. There's a kind of unease because he seems like somebody whose views are so contrary to some of the understood assumptions of American foreign policy over many, many years, that his appointment has stirred up more than the usual amount of anxiety that you'd have just because, you know, the guy isn't the Secretary of State or the Secretary of Defense.
My guest is Steven Sestanovich, and he's filling us in on how the National Security Council works. So you've answered some of John's question, you know, that it is not unprecedented to have other members of the president's advisors, cabinet, even a speechwriter in the case of Sorensen, in a meeting. But is it, let's say specifically, Steve Bannon's inclusion, or is it the exclusion of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the director of the National Intelligence that's really the rub here?
The announcement that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs and the director of the CIA wouldn't be automatically members of the Principals Committee was a bit of a surprise because actually over the past few years, those two people have generally played a larger role in NSC discussions. And I can't really imagine that you would end up with those people not coming very often. Because the issues that they have real authority on and something to contribute are really the issues that the NSC takes up every day. So I think you'll find in practice that those two guys are at principals committee meetings all the time. What the significance is that they're somehow only to be invited when their issues arise, I can't judge that. And it's a puzzle, but I suspect that in practice it won't really affect the way the NSC works.
So this has caused an uproar even among some Republicans and many who charge that Donald Trump is surrounding himself with the yes men. He's the people who wouldn't necessarily agree with him. You said a little bit earlier that the kind of conversations reflect the style of the president. What do you see here in this NSC?
Well, this is a very unusual NSC, to be honest. And what's very unusual about it is the following. You have a president with no background in national politics, and he's appointed a senior group of advisors who have very little experience, many of them, in running the agencies that they're now charged with. So that this group, the first time they sit around the table will probably be the first time that any of them has been at a table with any of the others. And their knowledge of what the president wants, their knowledge of how to work together, is going to be a work in progress. That's what makes the appointment of Steve Bannon, I think, seem rather unusual and disturbing to some people, because this is the person who seems to have an unusual amount of influence over the president. In this setting of basically quite inexperienced group of people, the opportunity may exist for a kind of undue influence. And I think that's what a lot of people worry about with Bannon's appointment, because he has is associated with such strong views, and such strong views that seem to cut against the grain of traditional American foreign policy thinking, that they wonder what role he will play. But let's not pretend that it's always been, throughout history, a textbook process. You know, Richard Nixon didn't listen to very many of his advisors. He listened to Henry Kissinger. And it didn't matter all that much who else was around the table when he told them what his decision was. So in every administration, you have to find out what the president wants, whom he's going to listen to, how the decisions are going to be presented to him, and hope that it is an orderly process in which views that should be heard are heard, in which the people who know most about the subject are able to get through to the president, and in which crazy ideas are if possible, excluded. What we don't know this early in the administration is whether that's going to turn out to be the case.
Stephen Sestanovich there talking about the inner workings of the National Security Council. He's a professor at Columbia School of International and Public Affairs and senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. And he served on the NSC during the Reagan administration. Stephen is also author of Maximalist, America in the World from Truman to Obama. And this episode of Civics 101 was produced by Maureen McMurray. If you'd like to learn more, you can sign up for the Civics 101 newsletter. It's called Extra Credit. And we promise it'll be the easiest extra credit you ever get. Just go to our website, civics101podcast.org, and click on the link to subscribe.
Word of mouth.
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 This is the Valentine's Day edition of Overheard. That's when people who work in radio tell you what they are listening to. And today we're going with the theme of, guess what? Love. Beginning with Sam Evans Brown, he's host of Outside In. Sam, what have you got?
So this one comes from someone who is actually a former producer here on Word of Mouth and on Outside In. This is a clip from Megan Tan's wonderful podcast, Millennial, which she bills as a podcast about coming of age. Started with the story of, you know, her coming of age, and now sort of moved on to other folks because, you know, maybe she's of age at this point. Yeah. Anyway, she is doing a four-part series down in Cuba. So she has headed down to the Caribbean and is hanging out on our favorite communist island. And the one that I was sort of most struck by is this story. It starts out talking about getting catcalled on the island by random men, moves on to talking about sort of relationships down there in this very sort of, you know, machista society, and how there's sort of, you know, there's a good side to it in which the women feel very, you know, taken care of and love being sort of doted on. But then there's the downside, which is, you know, the crushing domestic duties that they're expected to keep up with every day.
And look good while doing it.
And look good while doing it, I'm sure. But then the really striking part is Megan had interviewed a woman named Lisette. And Lisette got married, but then divorced. And she sort of swore off love. But then, of course, very shortly thereafter, met another man who happened to be married and has been carrying on a relationship with this married man for 20 years. Whenever he talks about getting divorced, she tells him, no, stay with your wife. I like it the way it is. It's a very remarkable interview. The reason that she loves this relationship is because by not being a wife, she's freed of all the domestic tasks that she had to do. And so that's my first clip that I've brought in.
Okay, now this is in Spanish?
It's translated, don't worry.
The Cuban woman has to do some chores that are not the same as in your case, because not all conditions are the same. I wash laundry by hand. There are lack of kitchen appliances, cleaning the house. So the time you dedicate to lay about in PJs, maybe I have to be filling up water bottles, washing clothes. To have a man and to have kids implies an additional responsibility to which I said, personally, I can't.
So that is Lisette from Cuba from the Millennial Podcast. So what, Sam, got you about this?
Well, it's just a very honest discussion of this sort of alternative arrangement that it's pretty rare to hear something like this without a lot of moralizing, and just frankly talking about why it works for some people and what makes Megan uncomfortable in talking about it. She's very open and honest about that as well. But then what I think is really striking about it is it becomes so clear that it's this lack of shared responsibility in the household that's really driving dissatisfaction for so many of the women in this country. First of all, I mean, awful. But second of all, when you're freed from that, and when Lisette talks about being freed from that, it's really striking. And that's clip number two.
Okay, let's hear it.
I asked Lisette what her life would be like if she didn't meet this married man.
Si no hubiera encontrado las alas.
I wouldn't have found the wings.
¿Cuáles alas? What wings?
Las alas para volar. Las alas para volar no las hubiera.
The wings to fly. The wings to fly, I never would have found them.
Yo me convertí en alguien totalmente independiente.
I became someone completely independent.
That's so interesting. So, of course, without the traditional bounds of marriage, you are independent, but all of the security, all of the things that people seek doesn't come with that either. And especially in Cuba, you know, women were supposed to be part of the revolution, and it sounds like they didn't quite get there.
Culture gets in the way, you know? And so that's why I think, you know, for this Valentine's Day, if you're looking for something nice, you know, maybe you should just, if you're a dude, maybe you should just think about getting out the vacuum cleaner and making that a habit.
Sam, that is an excellent idea. Maureen McMurray is with us, too, our executive producer. She's running the board for us today. Maureen, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. So, as you guys know, this is going to be my first Valentine's Day in many, 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 many years as a single person for reasons that are not safe for radio.
So tell us why, Virginia.
Yeah, okay, that's for another time. But so I guess part of the interest for me was looking for something that is not that traditional narrative, and sort of like you came up with, Sam, this kind of idea of not moralizing about how people choose to live their lives. And I couldn't help but think of this episode of Love and Radio. I don't know if you guys have heard it, but it's called A Girl of Ivory. So basically, it's from season 5 of Love and Radio. It's a series it's a podcast series that's on Radiotopia. And this is a conversation with a guy named, at the beginning of it, is Dave Cat and his wife, Shidore, she's also called Shichan sometimes, about their lives together. And she's Japanese origin, how they met, you know, their marriage. And then they introduce another woman, a Russian emigre named Elena, who came to live with them. And they're kind of explaining how it works with three of them in this relationship. And what gets revealed very cleverly, kind of graph by graph, is that Shadore and Elena are companion dolls. They are gynoids, as Dave Cat calls them. So that means like android is made to look like a man. Gynoid is like a robot that's made to look like a humanoid female. This guy's working a $10 an hour job in some Detroit suburb. He saves up for a year and a half, $6,000, and orders this doll from Japan. She arrives. Here he is. He's describing, you know, she'd come in the crate. He dragged her into the living room, and he starts opening it up.
Undid each screw, undid the padlock, pulled the door open. There's like a sheet of semi-translucent plastic. Cut the plastic away. And I didn't even pull it away all the way because, I mean, I saw her face staring at me. I was basically immobile for like 2 minutes because I was so taken with her beauty. I did lean in and I was just gazing into her eyes, and then I kissed her. And it was, yeah, she's rubbery, but I mean, that's to be expected. She's silicone, but it does feel like they feel like organic lips.
Well, okay. She's rubbery.
Besides my terrible edit that you must have heard there. I mean, what do you think when you hear that?
I think, I mean, it takes all kinds. And I actually did listen to that piece. What was it called? A Girl of Ivory?
Yes, exactly.
And his affection for these dolls is real. I mean, you actually think, listening to the first part of this interview in the segment, that he is talking about real people that he's deeply in love with. Mm-hmm. It's remarkable.
Yeah, it's two different performers playing these women. Basically, he's created this backstory for them about how they met and how they came into his life. And I remember actually years ago seeing, I think it was in Aperture magazine, there was a photo essay by some Danish photographer that had men and their companion dolls, you know, like sitting at the breakfast table, you know, with the family, sitting with mom and dad on a love seat, like she'd become part of the family. And I went from this kind of like, oh, that is so creepy, to a kind of, well, sadness, you know, but there was a kind of tenderness in the way that they dressed them and took care of them, and they were more than material to them.
And it's a pretty stable relationship. You know what you're getting.
Is actually part of the point here. In fact, Nick Vanderkolk asks, you know, are you just afraid of relationships with a real human being? And this is one of the things that Dave Cat says. It's edited.
99% of one's life is going to be out of one's hands. So it's like when I come home, I have these dolls who are my partners and my lovers and whatnot. I know that they're never going to be horrible to me. But then you get people who are just like, well, Dave Cat, you say that. Most real people in real relationships don't want to have control over their partners. I say there is. I say there is not a single person on the face of the earth that's in a relationship that doesn't want to make sure that their partner is not going to be horrible to them or leave them or cheat on them or whatever. The thing is, you can't control organic beings. It's A, impossible, B, wrong. But if you have a synthetic partner, then it's not immoral. But of course, the way I have my relationships is that, you know, they're more in charge than I am.
I think what's distressing is that, you know, he's never going to be surprised either. He's given up the lows, but he's given up the highs, too. I think that's what's unsettling about it.
With this synthetic partner? Well, I don't want to laugh, but it's such a delusion that people can go into loving somebody with, you know, this sort of gobsmacked romantic idea of perfection, of sort of, you know, soulmateness that doesn't, as you say, have any surprises or, you know, a will of its own. I don't know. Am I sounding cynical about relationships right now?
No, I mean, that's the thing, is part of love is heartbreak, and he won't get heartbreak with these dolls, but it'll catch up with him in some shape or form, I would imagine.
But do we know that? I mean, he could just have a really happy existence with his two dolls.
Exactly. He might be, you know, he might be all the wiser here, and we're just, you know, clinging to our norms.
Okay, so that was from Love and Radio. This is Overheard, our Valentine's Day edition. So far, so far taking some really different views of love. What have you got for us, Maureen?
So ours, I'm kind of going with the heartbreak route of love. There's this new podcast that just came out from Louisville Public Media. They partnered with the rock label Kill Rock Stars, and it is the 20th anniversary of the release of the late singer-songwriter Elliott Smith's album Either Or. So they just came out. There are two episodes. And the first clip I'm going to play, if people aren't familiar with Elliott Smith, they may recognize his music from the film Good Will Hunting. And that film came out in 1997. And they give this great backstory that Gus Van Sant, I guess initially the filmmakers Matt Damon and Ben Affleck, when they had the screenplay throughout the entire film, they just wanted world music to play. But then Gus Van Sant heard music from Elliott Smith and just sort of went rogue and decided to score the film with the songs of Elliott Smith's that had already existed. So this part of the documentary, it's actually another filmmaker, Lance Bass, talking about bringing Elliott Smith to the screening of Good Will Hunting, and he's going to give an answer, yes or no, if they can use his music for the film. So here, we'll start.
And so Gus invited Elliott and myself, and I was dating, and I'm married now to Corinne Tucker, and she came along, and can't remember if, like, you know, I might be exaggerating this in my mind now, but maybe Danny Elfman was there.
I just wanted to, you know, call you up before you left.
I'm taking all these job interviews and stuff, so I'm not going to be just a construction worker.
Well, you know, I never really cared about that.
Yeah.
I love you. Well,
you take care.
Watching that film and seeing how strongly Elliott's songs worked with the footage was really intense as well, because, you know, certainly Elliott didn't write those songs to be in that movie, and that film wasn't shot to go to those songs, but then just the mood and nuance of Elliott's playing and voice, even if the lyrics aren't a one-to-one match, they connected with the tone of that film and really added to it and gave it a sense of specificity in its emotion that wasn't just as broad as like a big Hollywood coming of age portrait of a young troubled man.
Okay, so the reason why I chose this podcast is I started listening to Elliott Smith in 1997 around the time of Good Will Hunting. And at that time, I was 18 years old. I was a freshman in college. And I just, even hearing that music now, I have a physical reaction. Like my skin just tingles, and it brings back to the surface all of these like raw emotions that I feel that you can only have when you're that young. I was going through my first loves and my first heartbreak. And listening to Elliott Smith when I, you know, discovered him for the first time, I felt that his music really punctuated and captured that in such an incredible way. And so when he wound up taking his own life, when I heard that, it was just heartbreaking. It just really affected me in a way that no other musician's death has. And, you know, gosh, that was 1997. So 20 years later, I would think that, you know, perhaps I've matured a little bit beyond it, but just hearing that music and hearing people talk about him, and in the podcast you get to hear Elliott Smith talking about his music, it just brings back these really complicated emotions that I had around love at that age. And it's just a really wonderful series and tribute to him.
Sam's nodding all throughout your conversation. What are you thinking, Sam?
Well, I mean, obviously, I listened to Elliott Smith when I was a sad adolescent as well. And I actually kind of wonder, you know, what are sad adolescents listening to now? Do they rediscover Elliott Smith, or do they have to
Joni Mitchell? Yeah. Do they rediscover Joni Mitchell?
I don't know.
But, I mean, I couldn't agree. I haven't listened to this podcast, but I could not agree more with the sentiments about the music and about that movie too. I mean, the way I still find that to be one of the most impactful movies I've ever seen. I think the music was a huge part of that. Elliott Smith was also in the Royal Tenenbaums.
Yes,
right.
Those scenes in which I forget the character's name, but when he's cutting his hair in front of
the mirror. Wilson's character.
Yeah, still some of the most like vivid memories I have are of watching that movie.
It's incredible. And it's, you know, and what's interesting about it too with Elliott Smith, and I'm glad that they, you know, they talk to a lot of music critics and everything, that it's not this kind of you know, trite music that you only appreciate when you're young. It's not juvenile either and stands the test of time. And I still love it deeply. So that is my Valentine for today, is everyone who has ever loved Elliott Smith to go and listen to that podcast. It's called Say Yes.
You never forget your first heartbreak song.
I know.
I guess. This is the Overheard Valentine's Day edition. Love many ways as it is, and still my favorite drug.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. And today is Valentine's Day, a multi-billion-dollar boon for retailers and restaurants catering to celebrating couples. Spending by young, affluent singles, however, may have even greater revenue potential, at least in China, where Singles Day spending far outpaces Valentine's Day, Black Friday, and Cyber Monday for online sales. What started off as a fun day for anti-couple crusaders to karaoke and go on blind dates has been rebranded by Chinese viral superstore Alibaba as a day for the unattached to treat themselves to online splurges. It is now by far the largest online shopping day in the world. Lian Chan wrote about Singles Day for Forbes magazine, and we spoke with her back in 2015.
So there are many different versions of how it started, but pretty much the holiday was actually really invented by Tmall.com, which is one of Alibaba's leading e-commerce sites. They invented this 24-hour sale 5 years ago in 2009 to really take advantage of really when young people in mainland to encourage them to either celebrate or lament being single. The holiday gets its name, there are four ones in its name because it's on November 11th. And it looks like four bear sticks, which in Chinese it means guangguan, which refers to guys who are single.
Hmm. So it sort of started as a single guy's holiday?
Yeah, so it started as like in college where it became popular in dorms where single guys just want to hang out and either celebrate or lament being being alone.
So is it celebrated widely in China, or is this a kind of urban phenom?
It's pretty urban. It really started out as a phenomenon in colleges, in urban cities, and then it kind of started out now really across the country. Still, the main force is among the biggest cities, but some second-tier cities and rural area have started to join it online as well.
So how do singles mark the day today? Any specific things that they do besides apparently buy things?
Well, that's actually one of the biggest part is that they go and buy things for other people. It's increasingly become like a online shopping holiday for them. And of course, there are people who just kind of go out on dates and try to use it as an excuse to go and hang out and go sing karaoke with their group of friends.
That all sounds like they're sort of celebrating, but I'm interested in the lamentation here. People even hire fake significant others on Singles Day. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so definitely there's this element that, you know, being single is not necessarily something to be proud of sometimes in Chinese cultures. There's pressure from traditional value and from family. So sometimes guys and women would invite their friends. And in some extreme cases, there may be fake significant others to invite them for dinner. But that's not that common. And in general, I think most people actually celebrate it rather than just complaining about it.
And they're buying gifts for others, not necessarily for themselves, or is that
sometimes they
too?
Buy it for themselves too. It's just kind of like a Thanksgiving here, mostly buying it for others, but also a way to reward themselves.
Why do you think this has taken off so much in China, and why at this particular time?
Well, I think in general, I mean, I think it really coincides with the boom of e-commerce in China. Young people, especially the young urban type, really start to take advantage of online shopping, just like this here in the U.S. So it was very shrewd of Alibaba and its site to really take advantage of this trend. And also just in general, I think there's a lot of self-mocking culture going on. Mm-hmm. with the boom of internet and technology in China. So people like to make fun of themselves online.
Well, last year, Singles Day broke the world record for highest online sales revenues generated by a single company in a single day. Leanne, do you think this is a kind of barometer of anti-Valentine's Day sentiment, or is this just, you know, another great reason to buy?
I think it's a combination of both. I think people really see it as an advantage of great opportunity to buy because there are a lot of good sales going on, just like Thanksgiving and Black Friday here. But on the other hand, I think the boom and the development of internet culture in China really provides the opportunity for people to mock themselves and take this as an advantage to enjoy the holiday and make fun and hang out, have fun with their friends.
Well, now that Alibaba has made this huge global IPO, are there plans to make Singles Day work elsewhere?
I think Alibaba is really trying to push it for to around the world, too. I mean, with Chinese people, there are a lot of Chinese immigrants around the world. They're trying to encourage them to shop on this day, too. And I think eventually their ambition is to promote this to even people from of, you know, different cultures around the world. Now, whether that's successful or not, only time will tell. But so far, they've been trying really hard to, you know, connect with international retailers, at least to attract the Chinese consumers.
I can't help but think of Beyoncé's hit, you know, All the Single Ladies, which became this kind of anthem for women making demands or wanting to get married. Do you think that Singles Day as a concept would take off in the U.S. in the same way?
I think it could be. In China, obviously, there's culturally, there's much more pressure on being single. The values are relatively more conservative. So definitely there are young people feeling the pressure to not be single. But in here in the U.S., I think relatively that pressure is lower. But people can still have fun like they do in China.
Well, Leanne Chen, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks.
That was our previous conversation with Leanne Chen, who wrote about Singles Day for Forbes magazine. Thank you so much for spending some of your Valentine's Day with Word of Mouth. Music in this episode came to us from Blue Dot Sessions, Jason Leonard, Brooke Raffree, and David Seste. There is loads more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. We're on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio, on Twitter at Word of Mouth, and the Word of Mouth podcast is on Google Play and iTunes. Just search Word of Mouth NHPR. And we encourage you to share what you hear with your friends, because things go that much further when shared by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Have a lovely day. We'll be back with more Word of Mouth tomorrow, too, here on NHPR.